Hi, my name is Richard Hornick. I'm 72 years old. Today is October 4th, 2007. We are in Baltimore attending the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society meetings. And I'll be talking with a close friend and colleague, Hal Hendrick.
My name is Hal Hendrick. I'm 74 years old. Today's date is October 4th, 2007, and we're in Baltimore, Maryland, at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel, where we are having our Human Factors and Ergonomics annual meeting. And I am a colleague and close friend of Richard Hornick.
Hi, Hal.
Hi.
I know we were talking a little earlier, and in the little break that we had, I know that we mentioned one or two items that we might want to cover during the time that we're talking now.
Sure.
One of the things that interested me that I know we didn't touch on was that in your professional experience, you were not only president of the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society, but you were also president of what you call IEA, which obviously many people don't know what that acronym means, but it's the International Ergonomics Association. You might tell me a little bit about both, what that association is and what your role was and what you did as president of IEA?
Sure. The IEA, or International Ergonomics Association, is a federated society of all of the human factors and ergonomic societies around the world. All told, it covers societies in about 50 countries. And my role was, first of all, as a voting delegate to the council, the governing council of the IEA. And then after serving that role for about 6 years, I was elected as the secretary general of the society. And then later was elected the president of the society. And altogether, I've had about 25 years of time, about the same amount of time that you served on the board and in various positions for the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society. I was doing the same thing at the international level. So I had those positions. I also served as the head of one of the major standing committees, which was the Science and Technology Committee of the Society. And basically what the IEA does is to promote international exchange of knowledge in our discipline of human factors and ergonomics through various ways, such as sponsoring international conferences on specific topics. A major emphasis is on trying to improve working conditions in developing countries through the application of our field. And the IEA tries to help by training people in those countries to be able to carry on our profession. One of the big benefits to me personally was the fact that in that role, I got to know people from all over the world in our profession and also did a great deal of traveling. I've traveled to about over 70 countries now. And the opportunity to not only learn more about our profession as it's practiced around the world, but also to get differences in perspectives about life, about reality, about our own United States culture, which, of course, is was a tremendous learning experience for me.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't know you'd traveled to 70 countries around the world. I know that you travel a great deal. I suspect that maybe what you really ought to do is have about 30 or 40 different homes around the world so that you don't have to keep coming back to Denver all the time. I have to realize that your perspective on what we do here as far as design activities and so on in the United States really has implications for what we call globalization now, where we have to be more aware of things in the world as it affects what we do in this country as human beings as well as professionally.
Absolutely. And in fact, I'm very encouraged by the latest efforts of strategic planning within our professional society here in the U.S. to put more emphasis on globalization, and also, I think, from a social responsibility standpoint, to be more concerned about how can we further help bettering the human condition in the industrially developing and agricultural countries of the world.
You know, Hal's, somebody asked me something the other day, and that I didn't know how to answer it, and that was, you and Hal collaborate about a lot of things, like we just put on the president's session yesterday that you and I co-chaired.
Right.
And we did the same thing last year in San Francisco, and we've partnered on various professional panels and been speakers at various meetings. And they asked me, that person asked me, how did you and Hal first meet? And, you know, I couldn't answer that. I couldn't recall how we first met. Do you?
No, I don't. As a matter of fact, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure how we actually met. Maybe it's too long ago, and we're at our age, we've just simply forgotten.
Well, we've both been presidents of the society. We both served a long time on the executive council.
Right.
You were a professor at USC, and you're now considered professor emeritus because you're basically retired from USC, but you have that honor. I never went to USC, although I've spoken there. So we've got quite a bit of overlap professionally. In that process, I know we recognize, other people recognize, that we've become close friends as well as our wives. Your wife Mary, my
That's
wife
true.
Mona. Anytime we're at a professional meeting together, we go to our professional responsibilities, and the ladies go out shopping or to museums or go touring and all that, and they thoroughly enjoy each other.
That's true.
In fact, this year my wife was not able to come, but one of her regrets of not being able to come was not having that special time with Mary that she could enjoy.
Right, and Mary was disappointed that she wasn't able to come as well.
You know, you mentioned yesterday in our session when we gave our respective little presentations which really centered around some of our most enjoyable professional experiences, as well as the negative side of the coin of what did we do so badly where we messed up that we should have known better,
right.
Which made it a fun kind of session. I talked about my experience with the Apollo program, which be happy to describe too, but you also worked and mentioned that you worked on a space program around the same time that I did in the early 1960s, and you worked on, as I recall, the dinosaur program.
Right, which probably nobody knows about anymore unless they've got gray hair.
well, tell me.
The dinosaur was like a baby space shuttle. It looked just like it, but it was much smaller back in those days, and it was the military's space program at the same time that the Gemini program was ongoing. And it only had two astronauts in it, and I worked on the design of the instrument panels for the vehicle. But it was canceled later when it was decided that we couldn't really afford both the NASA programs and the Gemini program. I got to have some fun on it and doing some design before they canceled it, but that was the beginning of it. But, you know, I think one of the things that was so neat that we were fortunate to do is the fact that we were both involved early on in the space program when it was such an exciting and new venture, when we really had so much to learn and knew so little. For example, one of the things I had to do on that was they initially designed the instrument panels so that the controls were based upon the specifications for aircraft. But they forgot about the fact that early on, because we didn't know what was going to happen in terms of pressurization in space, they had to wear those big clumsy spacesuits, pressurized spacesuits, while flying the instruments. And, of course, they had those big heavy fingers. So we had to literally go back and redo the entire instrument panel to provide adequate spacing and large enough controls that they could be operated with those clumsy pressure suits. And just as one kind of an example. But I'm fascinated about your opportunity because you worked for quite a while on the Apollo program.
Well, that's interesting that we're talking about that period where humankind was really venturing into space. And when I talk to younger people and I talk about the Apollo lunar landing program, they have kind of a blank stare, and it seems like almost like fiction to them, or maybe Model T invention time experience, or Christopher Columbus discovering America. It happened way back there somewhere and doesn't seem to be real. It's familiar with our first space ventures were with the Project Mercury, which was a single man or single astronaut capsule, and then the Gemini, which you mentioned, which involved two people, and our first venture since actually walking out of into space, leaving the space capsule, and then followed eventually by Apollo with the three astronauts, that two of which would go to the moon in another vehicle carried with Apollo.
Including one of our fellow Purdue graduates, Armstrong.
That's Neil Armstrong, that's correct. But that was an exciting time, and we worked. I was at North American Aviation at the time, which had a contract to NASA to develop the Apollo Command Module, which carried the three astronauts to the vicinity of the moon. And even though we worked virtually around the clock, you never felt like you were working. It was such an exciting goal, humankind getting to the moon. And I think many of us that worked on the project, even if we felt we couldn't make our way back, would have gone just to be able to walk on the moon. It was such an exciting goal to have. But there were many colorful experiences with that. The astronauts themselves were a very exciting group, and being a young test pilots, accomplished test pilots, kind of a wild, crazy bunch in some respects, but they all had their own individual personality characteristics and were different as well as being the same, as it were.
Yeah.
And I remember one highlight was in that career experience was being a project manager of what was called the Apollo Manned Centrifuge Program, where we ended up spinning the astronauts up to a load of 15 Gs, which to represent some acceleration conditions that they could experience under certain circumstances in the Apollo. And we had test subjects like Pete Conrad and John Young and Scott Carpenter and so on. And one of the things that we did in recording their performance under these high G loads in the centrifuge was to record their whatever they said in the experiences they were having. And Pete Conrad had such colorful language that on the transcripts that were recorded, we had actually three women secretaries who refused to type up his transcripts because of all his colorful words. And we finally, there was a older woman, probably around 70-ish there, who just put a bunch of asterisks in where all those words were. But when Pete Conrad was in flight, NASA took steps to make sure any transmissions that recorded from the spacecraft to ground control were delayed by about 15 seconds so they could censor
it.
It was a fun time.
You know, I also had opportunities to interact with several of the astronauts after I left that program, when I was the chair of the Human Factors Department at USC, because we had this graduate program in systems management. And they got very, very interested in our program because they later took over management positions. I think Scott took over the NASA Center at Edwards Air Force Base, for example.
Scott Carpenter?
Yeah, I think it was Scott Carpenter that did. And so he got very interested. And so we actually worked with Scott for a while on the applying our systems management principles and his using that information there. In addition, we've had a number of the more recent astronauts who are graduates of either our systems management or our systems safety program at USC.
Now, Scott Carpenter was a pretty unique astronaut. He was actually, one of my sons is named after Scott Carpenter because I thought so much of Scotty, because he had such a variety of interests. It was not just being an astronaut.
That's true.
He ended up actually later, after the Apollo experience, and as one of the test subjects in what was called C-Lab, where the laboratory was submerged off of Catalina Island in Southern California as a habitat to see how people could live undersea for a while. So he was interested in a wide variety of things.
That sure was. So those were great times that we got to share and to be fortunate enough to participate in those pioneering early days.
How long were you at USC?
19 years.
That long. Okay. And you mentioned the system safety. What did you call the department that you
It was the Institute of Safety and Systems Management, and I was the department chair of the Human Factors Department after I'd been with them for about 6 years. I became department chair, and then later I became the executive director or dean of the Institute of Safety and Systems Management. We had graduate programs and undergraduate programs in system safety, industrial hygiene, and then while I was there, we developed a human factors master's degree and then a human factors and ergonomics PhD program there. And we were actually graduated more master's degree students than any other unit on campus, including the engineering school.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And we were the seventh largest research unit on campus.
Now, you mentioned institute. That really is not like a school or a college within the university. How does it differ?
An institute differs in the departments tend to be more traditional, and they tend to be more stable. That is, they tend to go on and on and on, where institutes tend to sort of be created and serve their purpose for a period of time and very often then eventually disappear, which is actually what happened recently to our institute at USC. It no longer grows. It's a less permanent institution within it, and it's usually designed to carry out a particular purpose, often interdisciplinary, and that was our case too. Because we did involve management, we involved engineering, we involved psychology and human factors. It was an interdisciplinary organization to do interdisciplinary research as well as teach interdisciplinary programs.
And so I assume then that the other people, some of whom I know, people like Andy Amata and others, went into other professional application areas or different locations?
Yes, that's right. I failed to mention the fact that part of our program, especially our systems management program, we actually were teaching at over 70 locations around the world, about 30 of them in the U.S., and the others under contract with the military bases, where we were teaching officers and the technical reps on the various military units around the world. And that's part of how I got to go to so many countries that I failed to mention earlier, is because I taught in that program for 6 years all throughout the Far East.
Your background is primarily, or has been primarily, in the academic area and in teaching area. And of course, my bulk of my experience was in the aerospace industry having worked at North American Aviation and then Litton in the last 17 years of my career until 1989 at Hughes Aircraft Company. And one of the things that used to fascinate me was all of the politics that project managers played with in the aerospace industry and how they would try to basically outmaneuver each other competitively for contractual funding or personnel to staff their projects and so on. And I thought the political situation was pretty nasty. But then I also had an opportunity to do some teaching, as you know, at Cal State LA and Cal State Fullerton, and at teaching courses in human performance and industrial psychology as well. And then when I was exposed to the politics going on with the professors in the university setting, I thought, oh, these project managers are pikers compared to what goes on in the academic world.
Isn't that true?
He must have seen a fair amount of that.
Oh, yeah, and I sure did. I want to ask you something. What do you think, in terms of the various things, you've had so many accomplishments in your life, but what would you regard as the one you perhaps you're most proud of?
Well, we talked about the Apollo Man Centrifuge Program. I mean, that was the most exciting thing. There are other career highlights that I had that I truly enjoyed. After leaving the Apollo program, I worked with the development of what became the B-1 bomber, or it was called Advanced Manned Strategic Aircraft at the time.
Uh-huh.
And I was the crew systems project manager for that, so I and my people were responsible for the design of everything in the cockpit, controls, displays, the ejection system, radiation protection, and so on, everything for low altitude, high speed flight for a four-man crew. And then I worked on some Navy ship development programs when I was at Litton. One was called the LHA, which was like a small aircraft carrier, about 850 feet long or so, which would carry a few thousand Marines to a combat area. And had a variety of landing craft and helicopters on it to support their operations. I also worked on a new class of, I should say, I said new class of destroyers. They were called the Spruance class, the destroyer project for the Navy that now the destroyers are outdated and they use them for target practice and are sinking them. And they were new and advanced at the time. And my people worked with every aspect of both of those ships, everything from the weapon systems to the fire control systems to the combat information centers where all the controls and displays for the operation of the ship occurred, but also in such areas as the berthing spaces where the crew members had to sleep, the commissary, the whole food delivery system, and so on. So we were involved in every aspect of that, which was enjoyable because it was not just limited to a small segment of either of those ship systems. It was the entire ship that, we had our applications to. The latter years when I was at Hughes, I was manager of the human factors organization there, and we supported everything that the Hughes Ground Systems Group did, and that included air traffic control, communications systems, sonar systems, everything that was land-based. And that was enjoyable, too, because I got to learn about a variety of things that I would not have known otherwise. I never knew how a sonar operator, for example, could detect what was out there that he was listening to or looking at in the way of displays and say that, oh, this is a submarine with three blades on it, on each propeller, versus four blades on those propellers. Uh-huh. How do they get that from all these little wavy lines? You know?
Yeah.
So that was a big eye-opener. And in that process, you get to meet a lot of interesting people who are really specialists in these areas.
Yeah.
So you get to interact with air traffic controllers and on a real-time basis, and you learn a lot about what their problems are in the operational setting, which, unfortunately, the operational setting these days is not very good. I don't know about you, but I'm not all that comfortable flying anymore.
And it's going to get worse, too, unless we correct our air traffic control system. Yeah, I think when I think about my own case, obviously from an academic standpoint, I'm very proud of the fact of having developed the human factors programs at USC and also earlier at the Air Force Academy and starting the human factors laboratory at the Academy, which is now probably the finest undergraduate laboratory in the country. And so from an academic standpoint, having done those kinds of things has been good. But I think in terms of application, it was my work on the C-141 that I was most proud of, because I was able to, as it turned out, to have a lot of influence on the design. A large part because it was one of the first programs where we brought human factors in early in the design process. So we were actually able, you know, it wasn't a question of doing Band-Aid fixes when they found something wrong after it had already been designed. We actually got to participate in the design process up front and to therefore have a lot more influence in the design. Plus, I was actually in the engineering part of it. You know, it wasn't like an ILTI or like reliability where you don't get to be involved in the initial design process.
You mentioned the C-141. Probably many people don't know what the C-141 is. So you want to tell me a little bit more detail about what that is?
Yeah, thank you for I didn't. Yeah, the C-141 was a four-engine aircraft, basically a cargo aircraft that has been the sort of the backbone up until fairly recently of the cargo transport business for the military. And it has kits that can convert it into a passenger-carrying airplane and also a kit that converts it into for paratroop carrying and paratroop air delivery. But, one of the most satisfying things for me was that one of the nice things about our field is, I think, because we are involved in looking at all systems in terms of how they interface with the human operator, we get to know a lot about all the systems across the board, where most engineers are focused on their one specific thing, like on avionics or controls or whatever it might be. And as a result, I think we are often in positions to see things that the other engineers do not get to see. And one case in here was, I recognize that because we had these kits for converting the airplane for passengers and for aerial delivery, that we had many of the components that we would need if we wanted to develop a medical air evacuation system. And so I worked with the Lockheed engineers. At the time, I was the Air Force project engineer on this. I worked in the system program office for the Air Force. But I actually spent a lot of time working with the engineers down at Lockheed. And we worked up a proposal, which we sold, first of all, to the customer, who was the Material Air Transport Command, and then to the Air Force. And we therefore incorporated that. And if we had not had that in the latter years of the Vietnam War, we would have lost many more troops, because we did not have the capability without that airplane to bring the seriously injured troops back to the United States to get medical, you know, the specialty medical attention.
Yes, I know you mentioned that in your talk yesterday. And I found that to be most intriguing. That was a thing that I did not know about you, that you had that particular credit to you, that you developed that kind of a medical evacuation capability for such an aircraft. You also mentioned, as we were talking now, about your satisfaction with dealing with the whole big thing, as it were, not just a little portion of the system. And I know in our profession we talk about the systems approach, where we tend to look at, most of us tend to look at, the interacting variables and everything that comes to bear in a particular situation, and that we look at everything from nose to tail of whatever it is that we're working on, which is, to me, more satisfying than just working on a little specialized part of it. And I know that, you know, both of us do litigation work, and that's one of the things that I enjoy, too, from a systems approach, is that when I'm contacted by an attorney in a particular litigation matter, he or she might say, well, I'm really interested in the warnings aspect of this particular thing, or I'm interested in what fatigue would do to this situation, and they have a very, very often a very limited objective that they want you to address. And most often, when I get involved in a case like that, I'm able to point out to the attorney other areas that are involved. It's not just the warning issue. It's how was that person trained to relate to the warning? How was the warning designed? Where was it placed relative to other things going on in the system? And very often they're saying, oh, didn't think about that. And so mm-hmm. that's the enjoyable part of some of this litigation matter. And I know that both of us have quite a bit of experience with the process that makes us, quotes, qualified to be expert witnesses. And I wonder whether you've got any outstanding experiences that way that made you particularly angry or terrified or satisfied.
Oh, yes. precisely what you were talking about. So often you get involved in cases, and the attorney, as you say, has a narrow focus, does not recognize the full scope of the human factors issues that are involved in the particular incident. I've had that. My very first case that I was called in was in Hawaii, when a operator in the fuel storage area, which is very near downtown Honolulu, was filling a tank and monitoring the filling of a tank from a ship into that was being offloaded onto the oil tank into the area. And while the tank was filling, he got a call to go do something else. And so he started to go do something else, and as he was doing something else, he found his radio didn't work, so he had to go get a new radio, and then something else happened. And all of a sudden he remembered, oh, my God, I've got this tank filling. And about that time, a cloud of vapor cloud came off because the tank was overflowing. And two guys were running to, in an adjacent oil storage area, were running to turn off a transformer because they didn't quite make it. Mm. And so they were horribly burned and eventually died. But the interesting thing about this case was that it was one where the attorneys only were looking at one small facet of it. And there were questions they had, but they didn't know how to answer. For example, the defense was arguing, well, the tanks that have automatic shutoff systems on them and alarm systems, which this one did not have, overflow more often than the ones that do. Well, it was an orange, apples and orange comparison, for example, because what they were talking about is the ones that didn't were very slow filling small tanks that they hardly ever did in life. But so we got into the apples and oranges issue. I even showed by doing a statistical comparison of the data that they were citing that there was no significant difference anyway. So I got into the statistics and research design issues that were involved in this thing. As well as the dealing with obviously the obvious issues of what happens when you're giving somebody a primary task to do and then you go have them do something else, which they never should have done. And we got in then into their management's procedures, their operational procedures. So there was a whole series of issues that that were there that they weren't initially thinking about in this particular case that I was able to help them with. I might add, though, that I was a rebuttal witness, which, as you know, is somebody that's brought on to rebut an expert that's brought on by the other side. Unfortunately, the person they had brought on the other side as a human factors specialist had no human factors training. It was a psychologist with no human factors background. And after they read my deposition, they refused to put him on the stand so they could keep me off.
Yeah, I know. It's sad when you see one side of a litigation introduce an expert that they call a human factors expert, and that person might be an engineer who heard the term human factors somewhere, and obviously because that person is a human, they think they're qualified to talk about complex human issues such as perception and reaction time and decision-making and information processing when they are hopelessly unqualified to do so.
Right.
And unfortunately, if the attorney that's working against such a situation doesn't actually get a qualified human factors person, a jury can be persuaded to find in a horrible direction something based upon testimony that really is baseless,
right,
but looks authoritative.
Right. I got a question for you. I know we don't have much more time. How would you like to be remembered?
Well, basically, I'd like to be remembered as a good person and somebody who is a caring person and somebody who is genuine, not a fake. That is most vitally important for me as a person. Professionally, I'd like to be remembered as a person who tried to influence things that for the betterment of humankind. And I thought I was doing that in the aerospace industry by helping design systems that were going to be useful for the human operators, that would not be damaging to them from a health standpoint or from a safety standpoint. And that's the way I view the litigation process, too, that I'm in now. I find that to be satisfying for the same reasons, that hopefully my testimony helps take bad things off the market or makes things safer for people. And I spent my professional career doing something good for humankind. That would be my professional preference as far as remembrance is concerned. How about you?
Almost identical. As I was sitting here thinking, you were just almost iterating what I would say, the same thing. In terms of, first and foremost, I want to be remembered as somebody that cared about people, was supportive of people, for example, in our field in various ways, and that was seen as being truly authentic. And then having, in my own small ways, made some contributions to bettering the human condition through our profession. And so pretty much the same sort of things.
You suspect maybe that's why we're such close friends?
That might have something to do with it. Even though we have this little competition about Green Bay versus the Broncos.
Ah, yes, the Green Bay Packers and the Denver Broncos.
Now, as you know, we each year when they meet, the one that loses buys the other one and their spouses dinner. And it'll be interesting to see. Unfortunately, I'm afraid you may win this one.
I believe this is a good...
Given the way my donkeys are doing.
Yeah, this is a good year for the Packers, my friend.
Yeah. I still remember, though, that one eventful dinner that we had when Hendrick had to save Hornick with a Heimlich.
That's right. It was one of those payoff dinners, and I happened to be choking on a piece of steak, and Hal and his wife and my wife were in an animated conversation and didn't notice I was basically choking to death, but suddenly they realized that I was, and Hal did the Heimlich, and fortunately the third squeeze popped it loose, or I wouldn't be sitting here talking with you today.
That's right. You know, Rich, you're the, as I think about our times together, especially our times on the, when we were serving on the Executive Council of the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society, I've always been just so tremendously impressed with your level-headed and sound judgment and what you impart to the society and what you've imparted. I think one of the things that you can certainly be proud of are those 25 years that you've served the society, because I think the effectiveness of the society has directly been influenced by so much by you. In addition to that, as you got along in there, you had the corporate memory, and that saved us from reinventing a lot of old wheels.
Yeah, but I'm losing my memory now. Well, I think we have both of us have things to do from this point on, so.
Yep, sure
do. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Same here. It's been great, as usual.